Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, another key Obama administrator is stepping down. Peggy Hamburg, FDA commissioner for the past 6 years, announced she is leaving her post at the end of March, saying she does this with mixed emotions.
Well, she certainly racked up a number of achievements during her tenure, Mark. She worked to modernize food safety, oversaw stricter tobacco regulations, and improved the review process for medical drugs.
She has a very large territory to cover as FDA commissioner, with thousands of drugs to oversee, and the food stream often threatened by numerous toxins and pathogens that are harmful to the population.
Certainly, the FDA has had to adapt to a growing infiltration, if you will, of medical devices, wearables, apps that purport to improve health. The advance of genomics alone is changing the drug testing protocols that can take 15 years and cost billions of dollars. So keeping pace with this ever-changing landscape is no easy task, and I think people generally feel she did it quite well.
You know, speaking of changing landscapes, in a relatively short period of time, a new generation of parents has opted not to vaccinate their children in this country, and we're starting to see some of the dire consequences, Margaret. The measles outbreak continues to run apace, and the CDC is out with statistics. There have been numerous outbreaks across 14 states that began in 2014 and continue to spread.
You know, Mark, people just are not used to seeing this in the 21st century. Certainly, most of our provider colleagues haven't seen measles in their careers since we've had the availability of the measles vaccines, and thousands of people truly at risk for contracting these potentially fatal conditions, and in the case of measles, something that is just so highly contagious.
You know, I just thought years ago we were reporting that they eradicated measles. This whole issue has created a firestorm of debate as frontline providers. We're very concerned about the evidence-based case supporting vaccination of newborns, boosters for teens, and annual flu shots. It's eliminated so much disease, death, and heartache. Hopefully, this is not going to be a growing trend.
Well, we hope not. Vaccines and immunizations are the cornerstone of good population health. But I will tell you, nothing will bring this to the fore like people seeing their children sick. And that's a sad reality that we're going to try and prevent.
Our guest today, Margaret, is Adriel Bettelheim, Managing Editor for Health at CQ Roll Call. Has been keeping a close eye on the political goings-on in the Beltway. He's one of the top analysts on government health policy. Looking forward to that conversation.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, will be stopping by. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at CHC Radio. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Adriel Bettelheim in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. 80 million and counting, the estimated number of Anthem customers across the U.S. whose records were compromised by hackers. The nation's second largest insurer says hackers broke into a database containing records for millions of customers and employees in what is looking like the largest data breach of a healthcare company to date. The breach said to have exposed names, addresses, and social security numbers, but doesn't appear to involve medical or financial details. Anthem, which runs Blue Cross Blue Shield plans in a number of states, is going to reach out to all customers they believe were compromised and will offer credit protection services to those who wish it. California is ground zero for a major measles outbreak that was believed to have started at Disneyland, infecting hundreds of people with a highly contagious disease. The state of California is considering a law that would remove personal preference as a justification for not vaccinating children. The proposed California law would require all state children to be fully vaccinated before entering school. You can call him the genomics president. President Obama announced an initiative to advance medical and scientific research by collecting genetic data from at least a million American volunteers. The data to be used for large-scale studies on genetic properties of common chronic disease like diabetes, heart disease, even cancer. And according to a recent survey by NPR and Truven Health Data Analytics, a majority of Americans have no problem sharing their de-identified health data for research purposes. 53% of Americans say they wouldn't mind having their data used for research. However, that number is down from 68% a mere 6 months ago. Studies suggest folks might be a bit more skittish about privacy and security than they were last year. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Adriel Bettelheim, Managing Editor for Health at CQ Roll Call, a subsidiary of The Economist. CQ Roll Call is a leading provider of congressional news and legislative tracking, boasting the largest press corps on Capitol Hill. Mr. Bettelheim has served as health regulation team leader at Bloomberg News. He was a reporter and senior editor at the Congressional Quarterly and worked as a reporter at PolitiFact, the Denver Post, and Syracuse Herald Journal. Mr. Bettelheim has earned several awards, including the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting, along with his team, as well as the Sigma Delta Chi Bronze Medallion for Public Service Journalism. He earned his BA from Case Western Reserve University. Adriel, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Nice to be with you.
You have a great bird's eye view of the goings-on inside the Beltway. And, you know, there's an old saying, may you live in interesting times. And certainly for a health reporter, the gift that keeps on giving is the Affordable Care Act. You know, we estimate that 20 million Americans have gained coverage under the health law, and yet the GOP-controlled Congress is still talking about repeal. I think this was their 56th vote just recently, and yet really no focus in on replacing it. Can you give our listeners sort of the insider view of the political lay of land surrounding the healthcare law, where it stands right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's two types of legislation that the Republicans are pushing. One is kind of the broad spectrum, such as the total repeal vote that was taken in the House. And this would be basically the scorched earth, eliminate the whole law. And then there are more targeted strikes taking aim at the risk corridors that insulate the insurers from losses. The more targeted strikes, you could be looking at them as kind of bargaining chips for discussions later in the year when there's must-pass legislation, for example, to increase the government's borrowing authority. So you have to kind of look at it that way. But realistically, I mean, none of the big proposals the Republicans are considering have a chance of getting by presidential veto, even if they can get 60 votes in the Senate as long as Obama's president.
Well, Adriel, Orrin Hatch has just unveiled the GOP alternative that would eliminate the mandate to purchase insurance, but still offer tax credits for low-income Americans to buy insurance. And if something, let's just use the example of the medical device tax. If it gets repealed, certainly others affected by the healthcare law will be lining up to have their taxes repealed as well. How can the GOP proposals pay for the changes they'd like to see?
Well, I mean, I think that the math may not immediately line up, but they are also proposing to do away with things like the Medicaid expansions. I think the feeling is that something like the medical device tax is something that does not maybe gut the law, and it affects some Democrats in states where there's large device manufacturers, and there were a fair number of Democrats have put themselves on record as opposing this. So It becomes kind of a political cudgel for the opponents of the law to say, so no bend at all, you love this law so much you want to keep every T and I.
You know, we recently had Stephen Brill on the show, and he's talking about his new book, The America's Bitter Pill, which exposed the cultural underbelly in Washington that led to the crafting of the ACA. And you've exposed the sausage making of the Beltway. What are you seeing as you look out, both in Washington and at state capitals?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this was an exceptional law in that it really reshaped the entire medical supply chain. I think what's happening is from the beginning, when the Obama administration outlined its ambitions, it activated pretty much everyone up and down the supply chain. Now the lobbying is focused on, you know, myriad rules that CMS, the Department of Health and Human Services, is kicking out that continues to clarify the law. So there continues to be, you know, full-time lobbying frenzy and lots of money being thrown to this, analogous to the way that defense companies and communities rally behind certain weapon systems when they're being looked at for budgetary savings.
Another piece that we haven't focused on so much is the time-limited nature of some of the benefits under it. Can you talk about the challenge of getting that Medicaid pay parity to be reconciled anytime soon?
With Medicaid pay parity and primary care, this was a real problem because the law envisions Medicaid becoming one of the primary vehicles to expand coverage and to improve, you know, preventive care, and it counts on primary care professionals. But this pay bump, as it were, expired at the end of the year without Congress taking action. And now there's talk about reviving it and perhaps rolling it into whatever doc fix legislation emerges in March. It may be revived, but if it doesn't get revived, you're just going to end up having a patchwork where some states are taking care of the parity and others are not, and it will create a bit of a chaotic landscape.
We're speaking today with Adriel Bettelheim, Managing Editor for Health at CQ Roll Call, a subsidiary of the Economist Group. CQ Roll Call is a leading provider of congressional news and legislative tracking. You know, early on, the tens of billions of dollars were put in for meaningful use, trying to change the whole landscape of the use of electronic health record. And the president has recently, again, made his agenda clear that we must build an infrastructure for medical and health data collection that will enhance targeted precision medicine. Can you tell our listeners more about the president's proposal?
Well, on precision medicine, it is a commitment relatively small in this year's the budget just released, the fiscal 2016 budget, about $215 million to better understand the genetic underpinnings of disease and to use precision medicine that attacks the individual patient's genomic profile to come up with more customized treatments. They're envisioning a large amount of the sum to go to the NIH to set up a cohort of at least 1 million volunteers to participate in research to boost understanding of these diseases. Understanding that we're not in an era of as many big blockbuster drugs anymore, and that the power of understanding the human genome can yield all sorts of promising cures. Even in the House and Senate, you're seeing some efforts to speed up FDA evaluation of more next-generation 21st-century cutting-edge medicines.
There are certainly some measures within the healthcare law that are aimed at moving the country away from fee-for-service model and towards pay-for-value or pay-for-performance. And certainly Medicare has come out strongly recently saying what a significant shift it expects to see away from fee-for-service and towards value. You know, it certainly saw some penalties for high readmission rates to hospitals, and that seems to have been effective. Readmission rates are down for Medicare. We also see a proposal to finally repeal the sustainable growth rate formula for compensating providers who treat Medicare patients. Can you, first of all, for our listeners, explain what that sustainable growth rate formula is, and then what do you think is likely to come to fruition?
Well, the sustainable growth rate is a formula that was enshrined in a late 90s budget law that basically dictates cuts to Medicare providers. And it has been criticized almost from enactment, and Congress has acted to block these scheduled cuts on an almost annual basis. They would love to totally kill this formula and never subject Medicare providers to these kind of cuts again, but they have to find a way of paying for the cost. And the cost has been estimated at, you know, something like $140 billion. You would have to do something pretty big and significant to make it revenue neutral, which is the mantra here in Washington now. And in all likelihood, at the end of March, they'll pass another 1 or 2 year or some temporary patch while they continue to talk over whether they can somehow come up with a permanent replacement for SGR. The issue of value-driven purchasing that you raise is a very big deal. The Medicare, as you mentioned, just announced they're going to raise from 20% to 30% by 2016 new targets paying doctors and hospitals for the quality of care they're providing, not just for the volume of services. And this is a very big deal because the fee-for-service system has been enshrined in these big government health programs forever. But they're anticipating by 2018, half of Medicare fee-for-service could be shifted to one of these new models, and that could amount to $213 billion or so. Mm. So the question is, you know, do you need new legislation? Can they do this all administratively? And how can you incentivize some of this? And you know, they're using all sorts of mechanisms. They have these accountable care organizations, which were created by the health law and allow doctors and hospitals and other providers to share in any savings they get if they coordinate care. Bundled payments, another idea where Medicare would start paying groups of providers a set amount for a particular case. And then again, as you say, there's also a penalty side of this. The HHS secretary has talked about more savings coming from measures such as penalizing the hospitals whose patients are discharged and then readmitted within a month. The question is, how they phase them in, if it's gently enough that it doesn't endanger a great deal of opposition from the providers, and whether they can be a little more clear on what these accountable care organizations and new models are.
You know, you've done some analysis on healthcare spending landscape, and love to hear your projections for spending growth moving forward, but also sort of interested in the amount we spend. We spend about $3 trillion a year in healthcare. You know, the question is that bad? If we got good outcomes, would it be okay to spend this amount? And, you know, there's sort of the implications of if we start reducing this by large numbers, sort of have the same effect that happened in the defense industry. But the underbelly of this is about outcomes and then about jobs.
I guess the projections we're seeing are not like some of the major increases in the health sector that were seen in the 1990s
right.
and 2000s. So I think, you know, if the economy continues to recover and the health law expands coverage and baby boomers continue to join Medicare, you're going to see health spending grow. I mean, I think the projections now are something on the order of 5.7% annually through 2023. So health share of the economy is going to rise from about 17.2% to over 19% by 2023, and that's more than $5 trillion. I think what's difficult to address is a little sometimes precisely pinpointing the drivers behind the inflation. And a lot of people like to point to overutilization, how every patient wants the latest treatment and the most high-tech tests, and the doctors are loath to deny that, and the insurers are intimidated to deny that. So there's that sort of tension. But we'll see what happens as they begin to move to these different payment models we're discussing, whether they can actually, you know, bend the curve as the Obamacare architects were talking about. It's worth mentioning that this economic argument was really one of the essential arguments for enacting the law in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was the social good of expanding coverage to millions of newly covered people. But to sell this to the financial elites and the people who buy our treasury bonds, they had to make a point that this will eventually deliver long-term savings. And it's very much an open question what will happen.
Almost from the very beginning, we have been keenly aware that the Supreme Court was an unlikely partner in this health care reform. And certainly the landmark decision upheld the legality of the law, but allowed states to choose whether to expand Medicaid. And that resulted in a patchwork quilt across the country in terms of coverage. But now we've got the high court ready to hear this challenge on the legality of the tax subsidies for those purchasing insurance through the federal exchange. What are the potential implications of the decision for ongoing legislative challenges to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I mean, many of us were surprised that the justices took it on because it focuses essentially on an interpretation of six words in the law and whether the subsidies for insurance coverage will be made available to every state as the IRS has interpreted the law, or whether they are just supposed to be directed at states that took the trouble to create their own exchanges.
Right.
So it, depending on how you count these exchanges, it could affect subsidies in 34 or 37 states, and millions of people who have, you know, received the coverage starting last year would conceivably have their care arrangements thrown into chaos. The first thing we don't know is how the justices would rule if they upheld this argument. Would just all the people in these 34 states instantly lose their subsidies? And depending on how sweeping or limited the decision is, that, you know, would certainly open the door for both administrative fixes that Obama's team could make or legislation. But it's hard to imagine this Congress and this president agreeing on very much, especially if something as fundamental as the subsidies for insurance coverage and the entire reshaped insurance market gets thrown into utter chaos. So we don't know what's going to happen. And there are a variety of replacement plans and contingency plans that are being floated out there. But the HHS Secretary Burwell comes up to Senate Finance Committee to talk about her budget and gets berated by the Republicans for, you know, refusing to discuss contingency plans. So it's a lot of bad juju out there still. And a sweeping ruling like this is certainly just going to fray nerves and plunge the country and a lot of lawmakers who are a little, you know, have a little bit of health law fatigue right back into the right back into the vortex.
We're speaking today with Adriel Bettelheim, Managing Editor for Health at CQ Roll Call, a subsidiary of The Economist Group. You can follow his work by going to cqrollcall.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at ABETTEL. Adriel, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Nice talking to you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Is there a connection between illegal immigration and the recent measles outbreak? That's what Representative Mo Brooks suggested. But while it is difficult to pinpoint precise origins of disease outbreaks, there is no evidence supporting a link between the recent outbreaks and illegal immigration. In a radio interview, Brooks, a Republican from Alabama, said that the immunization practices in the home countries of immigrants who are living in the U.S. illegally could be responsible for outbreaks like the recent spread of measles. That outbreak includes most of the 102 cases in 14 states in the month of January. It is likely that the outbreak originated from outside the U.S., but the director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases has said illegal immigration isn't the likely culprit. Americans returning from travel abroad or foreign visitors could have brought measles to Disneyland parks in California. The countries under investigation as a possible source include Indonesia, India, and the United Arab Emirates. For part of 2014, the CDC was able to pinpoint the origin for 280 cases of measles. It counted 45 direct importations of the disease, which included 40 U.S. residents returning home and 5 foreign visitors. Only 3 of the transfers came from the Americas. As for countries' vaccination rates, back in the 1980s, Central American countries had low rates of measles vaccinations, but that's no longer the case. Since 2000, those countries' rates for one-year-olds have been largely on par with or have exceeded that of the United States. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Falling is a common experience among the elderly, and that is not good news.
If you're over 65 and you've fallen and broken your hip, 25% of them will die within 12 months. Another 25% will never be able to live independently, and a full 75% will never regain full mobility.
That statistic got former airbag executive Drew Lucatos thinking, what if you could apply the technology used in airbags to create wearable devices that protect a person from the impact of falling? So they did their research and found a combination of accelerometers and other sensors on the band worn around the waist could deploy within 6 milliseconds of sensing an imminent fall, and protective bags unfurl around the hip joints before impact with the floor, significantly reducing the blow to the joint.
Physics has taught us that bodies in motion stay in motion until they meet an immovable object, right? In this case, the immovable object is the living room floor. With the right technology, we can ensure that these people that meet that inevitable, immovable object, which is the floor, can not only survive that accident, they can walk away.
He founded Active Protect Technologies, and while his initial focus was providing a significant barrier to devastating injury in adults, he has additional potential markets as well.
With this type of technology, we can protect against concussions. We can now protect Coumadin patients. We can protect postal workers when it's icy out. We can protect our military soldiers from IEDs.
A simple retooling of airbag technology in a wearable device that could greatly reduce the devastation of hip fractures, leading to better health outcomes and better quality of life. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.